Welcome back to this week's Fear or Favour. Well, a fairly eclectic mix this week. We're going to look at Stop and Search. There's a big profiles case that's been talked about recently. We're also going to delve a little bit more into that strip search and what's happened to the police officers. This is in relation to this 15-year-old girl that was strip searched. And talk a little bit around Russia and the conditions that are now being imposed, not just in relation to some of the Russian oligarchs, but also the impact now it's having in the sports field. And I just want to explore the issue of, you know, should politics get in the way of sport? Should they be separate? And of course, everyone's talking about it, the massive trial that's going on in the US between Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. Nazir, busy week again for you?
Yeah, it's been a great week, actually. I got a new role as the new Chancellor of Manchester University.
Oh, brilliant. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. That starts in August, and 7 years, a real privilege. So I'll be carrying out... You know, people don't know, I guess, that Manchester University is the largest single campus university in this country, 40,000 students, 60 graduation ceremonies, 25 Nobel Prize winners. So I feel really, really honored to have received that role, and I will look forward to doing lots of graduation ceremonies in the months and years ahead.
That's a great role. Well, congratulations. And Manchester, Manchester's a beautiful city. Yeah. I've been there filming an awful lot. ITV used to have a studios there.
Yeah, they still do.
To go to. Yeah, which is, it's a great city, isn't it? So, well, well done. Fantastic.
Thank you.
So let's talk about Stop and Search. So this is, you know, as a police officer, Stop and Search is a really, really valuable tool because it enables you to identify in the amount of times that we've stopped and searched people and they've had weapons on them, they've had contraband on them, they've had something on them, but it is open to abuse.
Yeah, I think it's that element, isn't it? You know, disproportionately, black men particularly are 9 times more likely to be stopped and searched. There's more stop and search in deprived areas and, you know, areas where impoverished communities. But let's start with that, what you just said a moment ago. Stop and search is a useful policing tool and has on many occasions, as you've just identified, prevented more serious harm. Problem with it is that 3/4 of stop and searches achieve nothing, right? There's nothing found, no evidence found. And what I said a moment ago about the disproportionality that black men particularly feel that they are being targeted. The report that you've made reference to is one from the Independent Office for Police Conduct, which I'm sure is an organization we'll look at in more great detail in the months ahead. But the IOPC carried out a report. They've identified a number of individuals. There's one particular young boy who was stopped 60 times in 2 years. Now, that's like once every 2 weeks.
Sure.
But the other examples given of people being stopped and searched because they looked at a police car as it was driving by, or they're driving a car that doesn't fit their profile, whatever their profile might be, or that they were smiling as somebody walked by. You know, those are the kinds of, you know, there used to be this joke, isn't it, about, you know, you're arrested for being in possession of a smile or something. You know, so I think we've got the situation where it doesn't have the confidence that it needs to have. And what happened maybe 2 or 3 years ago, or 4 or 5 years ago, was the government looked at that and said, hang on, we need to put some more controls in place. And that meant that fewer stops and searches, much more intelligence-based. So, you know, rather than simply walking down the street and finding somebody to stop and search, you do so on the basis of intelligence that you make.
But where do you think this comes from, Nazir? Do you think this is stereotyping, profiling by police officers?
Well, that's what the IOPC say. I mean, it's not just it's not whether I say or not, but the research that the Police Conduct Authority and the HMIC and other bodies that policing say the same thing, that it is an element of prejudice, profiling. And it leads, therefore, to people being innocently stopped, innocent people being stopped and searched over and over again. I mean, there are so many examples of celebrities, Ian Wright, you name it. I think Lenny Henry in the past, you know, all of them have said that at some point they were stopped and searched simply because they didn't look right in the place that they were in the eyes of the person doing the stop.
But does this then stem back to, you know, racism that exists?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's you've got to train people We know, Nina, you know from your policing experience, my from prosecutor, we rely upon the community to provide us with intelligence information.
Yeah.
If you offend them, if you make them feel that they can't trust the police, they won't provide the information. It's critical that stop and search is done properly, that it's analyzed, you know, they feed back, you know, you have to provide, the police have to provide reasons in many cases. There's something else which we should talk about, which is Section 60, stop and searches. That's the Criminal Justice Public Order Act 1994. Yeah. Section 60 are the only occasions in which the police can carry out stops and searches without reasonable suspicion. So what happens, you know, it happens quite frequently. There's a knife murder, for example.
Yeah. It's a blanket authority, isn't it?
Yeah, so it gives a blanket authority in an area, say central Manchester, for the police to stop and search anybody they like for a certain period of time, authorized by somebody, a senior officer, and that's works really effectively in those cases, because it also acts as a bit of a deterrent. I mean, I've got an idea here, actually, that what the police should do, make more use of, is mobile phones. And remember in COVID, you get a message saying that you've been in the vicinity of somebody.
Yes.
Who's been infected. I think they could do something similar with Section 60 for sending out a message to pretty much every mobile phone in a certain area, you know, because it comes from the same the masts they use, saying we're now got Section 60 searches in place in this area, and we'll have for the next 24 hours. I think that's a very strong deterrent effect.
Good idea.
And doesn't take a lot of technology to make it happen. But Section 60 searches work as long as they're properly used, and we know they do. It's the fact that these individual searches carried out by individual officers that caused so much.
How do we tackle that, though? I mean, racism is endemic, and I'm a white person talking about that, but I do genuinely believe that the evidence supports it, that there is racism that clearly exists within police forces amongst police officers.
Two things, Mark. One is training, so proper training, and you weed out people who perhaps may not necessarily have three things, I suppose. Vetting is one, you know, weed out the people that are openly racist, overtly racist. Training, the second thing. And thirdly, you analyze those stops and searches that take place. So if there is one officer that's continually stopping and searching black people, which produces no evidence, that's grounds for disciplinary action.
I wonder if those are being identified within the police force. I wonder if people are actually looking at that, because that is a very clear indicator and sign. But you've obviously, as police officers internally, got to look for that.
Well, you'd hope that they have the systems in place, and whether or not they're being used or not, we don't see enough of. This is the lack of transparency. To build confidence, the public have to see that the police are policing themselves properly. Yes. And so when they come across an officer that is behaving inappropriately, illegally in some cases, then they are brought to book. And I think at the moment we don't know enough about that. So I think to rebuild public confidence, vet out those who are racist, ensure that you train everybody else, and also thirdly, that you hold people who are breaking the rules to account.
And one of my bugbears is the quality of police officers now. I firmly believe that vetting has become so weak in many areas of policing because of the desperate need to recruit numbers, that vetting has caused the people who I would say are probably not suitable to be police officers getting in.
Oh, that is what happened. You know, I mean, the government's push to recruit, try and replace the tens of thousands of officers they got rid of in the last 10 years, but to replace them in such a short space of time has meant the standards have dropped. I'm not saying, you know, obviously some great people are joining the police force, and I'm glad they are, but there are people slipping in because they've lowered the threshold. Yeah. And that, I think, well, you know, it's a recipe for disaster, isn't it?
I mean, I think the police, you know, when I joined the police service, it was a real honour. And I still take it as an honour now, having served as a police officer. But I do think that there are people who don't see the highness of the office. And it's the same as a politician. You know, I think when you get to those pointed to those positions in office, whether it be a police officer, whether it be a politician, you know, you have to continue to maintain those very high standards. And I worry that so many don't.
No, it's the, you know, the Warren card that you had, you know, the Queen's Warrant. It's an enormous privilege. Mm. And you're right, it used to be, you know, passing out parades, and it should be seen with the status that it undoubtedly deserves. But unfortunately, it's been besmirched by so many bad apples. I mean, heard again this week, where with evidence being given by the current acting commissioner of the Met, when he admitted, it's more than bad apples. Mm. It's pretty much an orchard, isn't it? And that, I think, is really damages credibility of 120,000 officers when it's only, when it's only a few hundred.
And it is always the minority. I mean, this is the reality of life. It's the minority that affects the majority. You know, it's the minority out there that cause the problems, that always respond to things.
Absolutely. The majority play their part. And this is about having proper whistleblowing in place, holding people to account. The disciplinary process must be quicker. It takes years sometimes for an officer to be exited. It needs to be more transparent, and the public need to be more involved in the priority setting by the police. All of those things will make a big difference. And I'm afraid, it's not happening with the speed that it needs to have.
And let's talk a little bit about discipline. So we had this case, we've talked about it, and it's received huge amounts of public attention. There's this 15-year-old girl who's at school. There's an allegation made that she has got drugs on her, although there's been a manual search and she didn't have anything. Police get called. They come. They take her to a room on her own. No teachers are outside. Just simply two police officers take her to a room on a 15-year-old schoolgirl who is in the middle of her period, and they cause her to strip, full frontal, remove a sanitary towel. These police officers have now been put on light duties. I'm sorry, unacceptable, utterly unacceptable. Why are these police officers not suspended?
Well, it was worse than that, because there were supervising officers who were aware of it at the time. There are a number of officers involved in this.
I think 10 in total, isn't it?
Yeah, the actions that are being taken are because they were caught out. It's only after the report was published that they decided the police did something about it. And there are issues for the school. The head teacher of that particular school has now resigned for health reasons. We won't speculate any more on that. But the police here, there's no – every time I go to London, and I have done in recent weeks, somebody's going to mention this case to me as an example of how terrible policing
it's
is.
It's shocking. It is utterly
shocking.
It
damages
shocking.
Absolutely everything about public confidence in policing. Mm. And as you quite rightly pointed out, the disciplinary needs to happen at speed and needs to happen openly and transparently. And these officers, if they did breach, which evidently they have, then they need to be shown the door. And I think that's the kind of message that ultimately restores confidence rather than, put them on light duties.
I mean, light duties is utterly ridiculous. These are still serving police officers. They've got a warrant and they are there. Removing them to light duties, I'm sorry, they should be suspended pending this investigation. Get on with it. Do a very quick investigation. It's already been done for you.
Children's Safeguard
and Board have done that investigation. So it's all the evidence is there. Get on, put these people through disciplinary process and get rid of them, and show very clearly from the Metropolitan Police and all the other police forces that you will not tolerate this behaviour. It will be dealt with swiftly and fast. And
I can't put it any better than you've just done. Yeah, it's been a massive drain and drag on public confidence, particularly in East London, in that part of the world. People are thinking, there have been demonstrations on a daily basis. People are thinking, how can we possibly trust the police anymore? We need them to trust the police because we need their intelligence and their information. We need them just to in order to tackle crime and criminals. But it's damaged confidence so much that it needs the sense of emergency that isn't being happened. The mayor had to tell them to suspend or to take action against these officers. That shouldn't be what the mayor does. That should be the job for the commissioner and the senior leadership team of the Metropolitan Police. And I think, and it shouldn't have had to wait until the report was published.
Why was this not internally picked up by senior officers or middle management? after it occurred. Yet they had to wait until a full report was done, it was made public, and then remove the officers from the front line.
Yep.
That's just shocking. That's
the same thing. Same thing happened with the terrible murder of Sarah Everard. It was only when the conviction came through that suddenly, oh, hang on a minute, maybe we do something about this now. Mm. You know, why wait 6 months? Why wait? Mm. All that time could have been used to try and begin to reconnect with the public, rather than wait until matters become public. And then it feels like you're being forced into doing something, which in itself damages confidence.
You know, we very often criticise senior management, you know, right from the very top. You know, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, both you and I have been very clear about our criticism of Cressida Dick. But actually, I think some of this really is a focus around middle management. You know, why is it that the sergeant and the inspector who are on duty that time, who are aware of it, didn't take action themselves? You know, why did they not escalate this to a point where it was dealt with? That concerns me. And that brings me back to this idea of, you know, group mentality, cover up, hide these issues, don't be open about it. Whereas actually we've got to be utterly transparent. You know, if I'm, you know, I work with colleagues all the time, you know, as a police officer, you work with colleagues all the time, but there has to be a level of standards. And I'm sorry, if someone slips below that, I don't care whether they're my friend. I really don't. There has to be a position where you say that is unacceptable behavior. And there are different ways of dealing. Of course there are, but this utterly overstepped the mark. I mean, that 15-year-old girl will
be traumatized and is traumatized. And, you know, I think, and of course, the school, which hasn't been named, but has been, you know, I think it's been mentioned in social media and stuff. Yeah, there'll be people in that school who just won't trust their teaching staff, won't trust local policing. You're absolutely right. People need to grasp this at senior management level, at junior middle management level. The perception become, if they don't, the perception is cover up.
Yes.
And cover up, well, when people start thinking cover up, then they start thinking can't trust them with anything, and that is a really bad place to be. Mm.
So let's move on to the war in Ukraine with the Russians obviously still continues, and I tweeted some time ago, and I'm still very clear. My biggest worry is how does it end? You know, where's the get out for this? And there's a very well known Russian oligarch, Oleg Tinkoff, who is a billionaire, set up a bank in Russia. He has come out and criticized Putin, directly criticized Putin. But what he's also said, and I think he's hit the nail on the head, is he said the West have to give Putin an exit plan, enabling him to get out. And the conditions that are now being imposed on the Russian oligarchs here, I just wonder whether is that actually making any difference? What is the impact? Because this war is still continuing, albeit we're not hearing so much of it now. Where does it end?
Neither of us are international mediators in conflict. Everything tends to end with a negotiated settlement of some kind or complete capitulation by one side, and neither is likely at the moment because the lines are so far apart. I think the broader issue, the kinds of issues that our listeners are interested in, is around the legal aspects and the like. You know, the reality is that people like this particular oligarch, they've got two choices. One is they can stick with Putin and say nice things because that's where all their money is, or they can decide, well, actually, I want to do business in the West and therefore I need to attack Putin. And my sense is that he wants to do his business in the West, which is why he's gone down that route, whereas others have gone back to Moscow or started hiding their yachts or their assets or whatever it is because they want to maintain their connection with Putin. Putin is probably, you know, people seem to think just of him as the president of Russia, he is probably one of the richest people in the world. Mm. You know, hidden wealth. I mean, we're talking billions and billions and billions, which, you know, there's no evidence of it. I won't say what the evidence is, but whether it was stolen from the Russian people or not, well, others can judge that. You've judged that already. There are other oligarchs who also, you know, they benefited from the collapse of the Soviet Union, and they are paying the penalty. Now, is it making a difference? Well, Chelsea Football Club will say it's making a difference, because, of course, their owner has lost the control of Chelsea Football Club. The oligarchs that have lost their yachts, who've had them impounded, etc., etc., they may think that they are paying a consequence for this. At the end of the day, tens of thousands of people have died already. Yeah. Some of the images we've seen from Mariupol and other parts of Ukraine are horrific. There is evidently war crimes that have been committed, evidently. I know the International Criminal Court are carrying out evidence gathering, going through all sorts of photographs and images and visits to try and capture enough evidence against the Russians and any member of the particular Russian military who might be responsible for some of these terrible crimes. We've heard of rape being used as a weapon of war, which is sadly a really common occurrence. And we've heard of young women who are now pregnant because of the rapes that are being carried out against them. You know, it is a tragedy of humanity. But it requires a solution of politicians. And as I say, as you said right at the outset, you know, Putin needs to somehow save face or be completely and utterly destroyed. I think the latter is unlikely unless people within his regime say we've had enough of him. And decide
he has enough supporters at the moment, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
I mean, I think one of the other things that's interesting is, from a criminal point of view, is these Russian oligarchs who have obviously backed Putin for many, many years, who have now changed sides or are saying something not supportive of Putin. Their fear now, of course, is their extended family are going to receive the might of Putin's anger, which may result in death. And I just wonder what your thoughts around that. I mean, my staple, my thoughts is that I think we're going to see an awful lot of people connected to Russian oligarchs disappearing or
falling out of windows. There's a lot of window accidents that take place involving enemies of the Russian state. You know, in English, we have a word called defenestration. We actually have a word for falling out of windows. I don't think the Russians have a word, but they have a lot of falling out of windows. Yeah. You're absolutely right. I think the reality is that if you stand up to the Russian regime, you won't be around much longer. Look at what happened in here. We had Litvinenko murdered with polonium in his in his tea. We had the Salisbury incident, instant murder, death, again, using Novichok. We've had a number of other instances of people being targeted here in the UK and across the world. Enemies of Russia and this particular Russian regime are really in danger and carry an enormous amount of risk when they speak up, which is why we need to provide them with an enormous amount of protection. Of course, the link to that is, why the hell were we taking Russian money? Why were our leaders taking Russian money for years,
haven't we? I mean, I think let's extend that a bit further. I mean, the power of other countries into other countries. So, for example, Russia or America, you know, they have sleeping cells sitting in every country where they have people that they can make active very quickly or bring people over very quickly in order to, you know, we've got very open borders now, so people can get in and out of countries very, very quickly via other countries to not raise the suspicion, particularly if they're coming from Russia, they come via other countries.
Yep.
So there's an ability to react really quickly. And of course, what we have seen is that the killing nerve agents have been a very effective way of getting rid of someone very quickly. And it's obviously much easier than bringing a gun because, you know, you can't trace those things. And I think we're going to see over the forthcoming months, not just in this country, but in other countries, people disappearing and people dying.
Yeah. I mean, as I say, it's a challenge for policing, because what we have to, policing has to provide protection for some of these individuals. But how do you protect against an unseen enemy? How do you protect against an invisible group of people that can be switched on and switched off as a blink of an eye? And there are so many countries. I mean, we maybe in a future podcast, we'll look at the murder of Khashoggi by Saudi interests.
Yes.
There are countries, unfortunately, don't care about territory and jurisdiction. They're more than prepared to go and carry out crimes in another country to further their interests. And of course, as some would say, the British are guilty of that too. So, we can talk about Gibraltar, where there was a few years ago where there was deaths of Irish Republicans. There is plenty of occasions in which countries don't really care about their own borders. They'll go wherever they want to in order to further their interests. But as I say, it's a challenge for policing. It's a challenge for the public. You've made the very strong point about it's not just the guns anymore. They don't need to use guns. They can throw them out a window. They can infect them in some way. And we've got to continue to be vigilant throughout.
You're a keen follower of sport, as am I. Mm. And I really struggle with this decision. So what's happened is that Wimbledon, June to July, obviously Wimbledon disappeared for 2 years, which was shocking. And I used to work for the LTA. I'm a tennis player myself, played at a fairly high standard. And tennis is something that I really love and enjoy. And I've had the honour of going to Wimbledon many, many times in the the players in the enclosures there, the members bar, and indeed I've had the honour of sitting in the players' enclosure with Mark Petchy, who's a very good friend of mine who looked after or coached Andy Murray. Mm. But one of the things that has just been announced is that the All England Club, Wimbledon, has taken the decision to ban Russian and Belarus players. And that has an immediate impact on two significant players and many others, which is Medvedev, who is number two in the world for Russia, and Sabalenka from Belarus, who's number four in the world for the females. Mm. That impacts on sport. Should politics, and this is what it's about, politics be impactful on sport?
Has it ever not been? I mean, I grew up with the boycott of the Moscow Olympics in 1980 by the Western powers, by, boycott by Russians of the Los Angeles Olympics in 1984. Do you remember the Black Panther movement, the salutes at the Olympics in 1968? Politics, you cannot divorce politics from sport. The two come together. We're in a strange situation. I have no problem with, for example, the Russians being kicked out of the World Football Cup because, that's the Russian team. Yes. I struggle a little bit with individuals. Which is what you have you've identified here.
And they're not representing their country. You could argue they're representing their country, but they're actually they're individuals representing themselves, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I think how the Olympics. Remember how the Olympics got away with that? They said the Russian government was banned, but people could still compete under another flag, which enabled them, the Russian,
representing as no country.
I wondered whether that opportunity had been presented to these people, and they were asked if they were happy to do that, and they chose not to. We don't know. Mm. There are ways around it, but there's a strong point here, which is that you've got to. We talked a moment ago about how you punish the state. Actually, punishing a country by preventing their sporting heroes from competing is one way of changing public opinion or impacting on public opinion. So just imagine if, somebody had a go at us and said, we can't send an England team to Qatar for the World Cup. I think we'd be quite upset about that. And we'd want to know why people, the rest of the world, decided to do that. Because we know the Russian, for example, the Russian people have been given lots of propaganda about the war in Ukraine. They're not getting to hear about what the Russian military are doing in Ukraine. And one way of them being impacted is for them to start asking questions about why it is that their heroes are not now being allowed to take part in sporting events. As I say, I'm a little bit... I have no problem at all with a country, as team representing Russia being banned from stuff. I'm a little bit torn when it comes to individuals, because then what do you do about, let's say, but we've talked before about Novak, haven't we? Our favorite Serbian.
Yes.
The Serbians haven't been as blatantly anti-Russian in their language as a country. Are we going to quiz him? Are we going to say, Novak, how do you actually feel about Ukraine and Russia? And he says, well, I'm not really entirely sure. Okay, you can't play now.
Yeah.
Are we going to do that now? Are we going to quiz individuals about how they feel about the war or about any particular political argument or conflict? Because I think that's not a place I want to be. I think the more I think about it, I have no problem, as I said, with the country itself being banned from sporting events, I'm a little bit more cautious about
it. When they come, I can understand Davis Cup, which obviously is the countries when they play tennis. So you had Russia or Belarus playing. I can totally understand the committee deciding, actually, do you know what, we're going to expel Russia or Belarus from the Davis Cup. What I can't accept, and I don't think is right, when it becomes individuals. And there was a recent quote that I saw saying that 90% of Russians are against the war. It's only the 10% there who are supportive. So what you've got is individuals being punished for their country. And you use that in any environment. You think, well, how can I be responsible for the actions of my government?
Well, where do you draw the line with that? This is the problem I have, is that we're focusing right now on Russia and Ukraine. What about Saudi and Yemen? Yeah. What about Israel and Palestine? What about conflict after conflict? You could end up having to make judgments. Sports shouldn't be having to make judgments about political conflicts. But as I said, I don't have a problem with the country. I have a problem with individuals. And if for example the individuals you mentioned were happy to drape themselves in a Putin's flag, well then maybe I might have a different view about them. But if they're simply being banned because they are Russian, I think that's a step too far.
No, and I think the men's federation game and the females federation game have both come out and condemned Wimbledon All England Club for the stance they've taken. I mean, I know the All England Club very well, having worked at the LTA and had a relationship with them. They are very much a law unto themselves. They have a very different status than everybody else. So I'm really not surprised.
Do you remember a few months ago we had that Chinese tennis player that made a social media post about challenging the Chinese government, and then she went missing for a little while, and then she came back, and for a while, you know, Chinese were being prevented from taking part in tennis events. Tennis seems to be at the forefront of the war on terror at the moment.
Look at our friend Novak, which we just mentioned, and when his the whole issue of him and COVID.
Vaccination. I know. I don't know what it is about tennis. Thankfully, I'm not a phenomenal tennis player. In fact, I'm a rubbish tennis player. I've got some good news on that front. I am going to be carrying the baton for the Commonwealth Games, by the way.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so I've been selected to carry the baton for 200 meters as part of the relay as it goes to Birmingham for the Commonwealth Games in Birmingham. That's 200 meters, which for me is a marathon, by the way. And I can assure you that my children will be laughing every step of the way. So me and sport don't go well together. But I think tennis seems to, for some reason, I don't know why tennis seems to be selected really for being the battleground for all these political arguments. I don't quite understand that.
One other thing that I saw this week, and just comes back as we're talking, is there was a police officer, superintendent from British Transport Police, and she basically came out and said that she thinks that there should be a law imposed against people on trains who stare at females. And her position was that she was very unhappy that there were people who were staring at females, and it gave them a very uncomfortable feeling, and it was suggestive that they wanted to be, to do more sexual harassment, etc. And I really struggle with this. I really struggle with this because I think there's no doubt when I've sat on a train, I probably have drifted off at times and just stared. I didn't stare at anyone in particular, but there may well be that my glance ends up going past. But I, the thought process that we have in our heads, are we really at a stage where we're thinking actually we should be policing that rather than actions?
Well, that's your point. We should be policing action and not thought. And there will be, I don't know what example she's pointed to. There are clearly occasions of people, we've dealt with them, I've dealt with them, of people who use public transport to further their sexual activities.
Trains. And I get really worried on busy, one of those times when everyone's squashed together. You get someone who's a sexual predator
absolutely
fine to go really.
We had upskirting. Upskirting was banned a couple of years ago. Men, what is it with men? Sticking a phone up somebody's skirt in order to
men have a lot to answer for,
don't we? There are crimes on trains and public transport that clearly have to be dealt with. You know, every case on its merits, that's what I always say. So, you know, if that man is staring, by the way, there's CCTV in all trains now, isn't there? So if that man is staring at that woman in a way which is evidently harassing, then I have no problem with using the laws that we currently have, and there are lots of bylaw offences as well. But you know, if you are just as I've done, I'm sure we sit there sometimes, and I just our minds drift because you know that's what trains do to you. And you, as a result of that, you're not really conscious about where you're looking, and there just happens to be a woman sitting in the direction that you're looking. Well, you know, that's a different kettle of fish. That's clearly not harassing, and I would hope that the police would never ever contemplate bringing that. Or bring me to justice for daydreaming, I guess. What I think we need to be conscious of is that there, you know, women need to feel safe, and that's and sadly there are lots of predators who will use those opportunities whenever they can.
But it's not about policing thought; it's about policing.
Oh
actions,
no, police actions, absolutely.
So massive trial in the US. We obviously saw the trial last year played out in the UK against the newspapers. So this is Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. Johnny Depp, very well known, very famous for his work in the Pirates of the Caribbean. He has currently launched a $50 million lawsuit against Amber Heard in relation to her implying that he abused her in 2018. She has counterclaimed, doubling that lawsuit to $100 million for nuisance and intimidation. Some of the stuff that's coming out in court is really, I was going to say horrific. It's not. It's just, it's untasty. It's nasty. It's pretty horrible.
Oh, it's very sad as well.
Sad, I mean, yeah, that's probably the simplest way.
I think, you know, I don't know Amber Heard at all. I've never really paid attention to anything that she's been in. I think she was in the Aquaman or something, wasn't she, or something? Obviously Johnny Depp, I know relatively well from not well. I don't know him personally, but you know, I've seen him on screen lots of times. Obviously, I respect his work. He did with Gosh, the Great Ormond Street Hospital. He's been doing a lot of work there and lots of charitable work. And the question we're beginning to see. I mean, as I say, let's not prejudge outcomes. We're beginning to see what domestic abuse, where man is a victim, looks like, and that's certainly the picture he's presenting with his evidence and with his witnesses. There's that he was being abused because of who he was. He wasn't able to speak up about it. That it was being used against him if he ever did speak up about it. He was quote unquote him suffering in silence, and that Amber was the the perpetrator. She wants to present this picture, as she has done previously, that she herself was being controlled in some way, shape, or form. As you said, the evidence that's being articulated in that court is terrible to hear. It's sad to hear. This is clearly a really toxic relationship.
Yeah.
Whichever way.
And Johnny Depp himself has been very open about his relationship with his mother as he grew up.
Yeah. And about he was in a toxic relationship with his parents, or his parents were in a toxic relationship, but he lived around that too. And he uses that and says that's one of the reasons why he hasn't spoken up previously, is that, you know, he thought it was.
And we do often see that, don't we? We see likes attract a like, and very often, you know, particularly within domestic relationships, the amount of people who are in a domestic relationship and move from one domestic relationship to another, which is abusive.
Yeah, and that's quite common. Very common. We have in this country, we have something called Clare's Law, which means that if you are you believe that you're in a relationship with somebody that has a history of domestic abuse, you can go to the police and they will check their records and be able to satisfy you as to whether or not this person's got previous. And that Clare's Law resulted from a fact that a man who murdered this particular woman had previous conviction for domestic abuse involving another victim. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they do move from victim to victim. And also, as you say, victims very often attach themselves to abusers, not because they want to, it just seems because that's the psychological.
Well, it's what they're used to. Becomes a cycle, and it's like any offending. Whether it be sexual abuse, whether it be physical abuse, it's about breaking that cycle of offending.
It is, and you need help for that. And we don't have enough help out there. If people like Johnny Depp and Amber Heard with their multi-million pound lifestyles don't seem to be able to get any help, then what hope is there for a young man or woman in a block of flats in East London? It's really challenging to get the help and support. What I think this trial is doing, take away the celebrity, is people beginning to understand how complex relationships are.
Yeah.
Not that we don't know they are, and how evidence is really important. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter what I say or what you say about who's at fault. We are hearing and we're seeing, another good thing is that this is being televised. So yes. It goes back to our earlier point. We need to see much more of this stuff in this country so the public can see justice being done. And I think, hearing evidence being challenged, cross-examination, then we ourselves can make up our minds rather than simply being told at the end of a trial, which is what happens right now.
And I think we've learned a lot over the past few years around gaslighting, around yep. controlling behavior. I mean, Coronation Street did a very, very good character sequences when they had Jeff, who was gaslighting. I found that really powerful.
It was powerful, really passionate, really well done. We've got to understand, coercive control only became a criminal offense in this country 7 years ago. So, we've only come to it late, but coercive control underlies every bit of abuse.
Yes.
Some of it becomes physical. Most of the time, it's just simply somebody controlling another woman or another man. More often than not, it's a woman. And I think we've got to recognize that training needs to improve. Our services need to be better at handling it. So if any good comes out of this trial, it's about us reawakening to the challenges of tackling domestic abuse and also ensuring that our children don't have to suffer.
And the other thing is, I find very interesting about coercive control is that, if you've got physical or sexual abuse, it's an action you can see. It's something that's there. Whereas coercive control takes place over many, many months, years.
Yeah.
And it's something very difficult sometimes for the person who is on the receiving end of the coercive control to actually recognize. And it's outside parties who will see that and see that first. And therefore, it's a responsibility for people's friends, families to identify this, to address it, to see what can be done. Because when you're living within that environment, you don't see it.
No, exactly that. You're being, that's the whole point. They're controlling you. So you're even controlling your emotions and your thoughts. But the neighbor, the school teacher, the family, other family members should be able to see that the person that they love or cared for or know is not the person that they knew a little while ago. And that, as we've seen in sort of dramatic and representations, it can be quite challenging to have a conversation with somebody that's being controlled, to make them realize that they are being controlled. But there are specialists out there who can provide that kind of service, who have that understanding, who can do some of that. So, yes, absolutely, we should encourage people to speak up, speak out, and to look after each other.
Brilliant. Great. Well, Nazir, another week has gone by, flown by. It's just, as you get older, I think time goes quicker, doesn't it?
Do you know? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. One day it might do. Another day drags. Today, unfortunately, it's really busy. And when you're busy, it goes much faster than you imagine. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, listen, look after yourself. Thank you very much. Please do keep listening. Do tell your friends about Fear or Favour and do subscribe. Also, let us know what you think about Fear or Favour. We listen to every comment that comes in and we respond to all of them. So until next week, thank you very much. Keep listening and tell all your friends. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.